We're delighted to have back in our fold here Leonard Mlodinow has given several lectures for us in the past. He is a professor here at Caltech occasionally, and he has a very interesting background in terms of having written for MacGyver and Star Trek. He was also a writer for Star Trek, which is pretty cool, which means you have to have a very creative mind and also be a good writer, which he is. He received his PhD in theoretical physics from UC Berkeley. And he was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. He's been on the faculty here at Caltech, as I mentioned. His previous books include Subliminal, about how subliminal influences our politics, our choices, and so forth. He co-authored a book with Deepak Chopra called The War of the World Views. In my opinion, he won the war. But I might be slightly biased in that regard. He also co-authored a book with Stephen Hawking, The Grand Design, in which they showed that models by which the universe could arrive on its own, sort of spontaneously, without an outside source. The Drunkard's Walk was really his most famous book, in which he showed how randomness and probabilities explain a lot of things that we are not intuitively able to grasp, anything from going to Vegas to playing lottos and things like that. Then he also, his first book was Euclid's Window, and then after that he wrote Feynman's Rainbow, about the beauty of science and nature. And his latest book is The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. A beautiful book, by the way. It's a nicely embossed cover. It's very well written. It's not just a history of science, but every chapter has some Len's own personal history of the science he himself has done and some of the famous scientists he's worked with, and as way of introducing different topics. And he had a wonderful op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times on some of the myths about science, which was really great. Please help me welcome Dr. Leonard Mlodinow.
Well, I'd like to thank Michael for that nice introduction. You know, when I go around the country and speak, I often, for some reason or another, Michael's name comes up, and I always ask, who knows Michael Shermer? And there's always a bunch in the audience who know him. And here I'm happy that 100% know him, so let's give Michael a big hand, because he's always getting other people's big hands. But this is a tremendous amount of work for him to do, even for someone like me, who there's no planes or trains involved in coming here, but organizing these events is very time-consuming. So. Thanks for coming to hear about the history of science, the human journey from living in trees to understanding the cosmos. And I'm glad to see so many people enthusiastic and interested in that. And luckily, we didn't have a really nice day anyway outside, so this may be just as good. I organized my book chronologically and divided the history of science into eras, different eras. The first era takes millions of years, and then we go to thousands of years, and then hundreds of years, and then decades. And if I were to write a second edition of this book a little bit in the future, I might have to do weeks, because the pace of scientific progress is increasing so quickly. But the first era, I start with the beginning of the human species. So we're Homo sapiens, and Homo is a genus, human, and there have been many different species through the ages of humans. We're actually Homo sapiens sapiens, a subspecies of the species Homo sapiens. And of all the species and subspecies of the genus Homo through the millennia, we're the only ones that survived. And scientists have wondered why that is, and of course, psychologists and neuroscientists wonder why we have the brains that we do. A lot of us like to think it makes us more intelligent than other animals, but there's a very specific way that we're more intelligent that was very helpful in our survival. In fact, 150,000 years ago, our numbers dwindled to just a few hundred, and we almost went extinct. But we survived because of our social cooperation. As different among all the species, we are distinguished by being the ones that have by far the most complex social cooperation. If you look into someone else's face, you can tell in an approximation what they're thinking and what they're feeling. You can tell what they're thinking that you're thinking. You can tell what they're thinking you think they're thinking. See, you can tell what they think you think they think you're feeling. But it's hard to say. It's hard to grasp in my mind as a sentence. But psychologists say we can go 6 degrees deep into this. And that takes a lot of computational power and sobriety, I think, too. So So that is really why we have the brains that we do, but once we have them, we can use them for other things, and today we use them for literature and poetry and science and mathematics, and that, of course, has changed the way we live. The first change that separated us greatly from other animals came around 10,000 BC with what people usually call the agricultural revolution or the Neolithic revolution. That's when we stopped wandering and being nomads who followed the water and the food and the climate and started settling down in villages. And in school, they teach, or they used to teach until recently, and probably I think still do teach in many places, that the agricultural revolution occurred because it's easier to procure food if you grow it yourself, if you domesticate animals and plants. But by studying the remains of peoples from those times and from times before, we see that that's not the case at all. That's totally wrong. The nomads who lived around the time of the Neolithic Revolution had a much easier life than the first farmers. They were better fed, had more variety, took in more calories, were better nourished, lived longer. And so why did we settle down in these villages? Well, interestingly, one theory comes from our turning our minds from just being an animal trying to procure food in our everyday needs to spirituality. So this Neolithic revolution coincided with the time when we built our first temples and in the villages where we started to inter the dead and be careful how we buried the dead. So it seemed to be a time when we turned our thinking from survival to existential questions of life. Why are we here? What's the meaning of life? What happens after death? That was a very important one. And so these peoples who lived in the early villages had no particular reason to settle down, except that they couldn't carry their dead with them. So the nomads, when someone gets sick, leave them there, or they're sick or old, to die, and they move on, and no one thought this was cruel. And the people die like animals and rot, and that's what happens to them, and it's just very natural. But in the first villages, people essentially buried their dead under the floorboards. They lived on top of their dead, and we find bones underneath the settlements. So we think that may be the reason that people first settled down. And with time, people realized that they could make their lives easier if they made one adjustment, and that is a division of labor. So in those early villages, for thousands of years, people lived together, but each family was self-sufficient. And then around 3000 BC in Mesopotamia, people started living in what we call the first cities. And what differentiates a city from a village is that in a city, there's a division of labor. And this division of labor, the beginning of different professions, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the tax collector, the policeman, these all required new technologies of the mind, namely reading, writing, and arithmetic. So this was the first step toward modern science, was really the invention of these technologies. And the initial technologies were not used for what we use them for today. No one wrote stories or literature. No one did scientific calculations with the first arithmetic. It was for keeping records for businesses. And so the first, for a long time, the only writing available were lists. And the arithmetic was accounting. And writing is a very difficult invention. It only happened, we believe, two or three times in the whole history of humanity. Everyone speaks, every tribe, every nomadic tribe that we've ever found over the last hundreds of years, especially when there were more of them, they all had language, but they didn't all have written language. And we think that all the languages we have today evolved from these beginnings. And the next big step happened in ancient Greece when the Greeks realized that we don't have to accept that the gods make everything happen, but that we can use our reason and our observation to form theories and to explain things. And a lot of their theories, I guess almost all their theories were wrong, but the idea to use theories and to apply reason was a great revolutionary idea. After that came what we call the scientific revolution. Now again, this is a misnomer. It's not really a science, it's not really a revolution. It happened over hundreds of years. There were a lot of different people who had different ideas. They weren't all fighting for the same thing, but it's gotten the name the scientific revolution. And it's where we basically invented the modern concept of all the sciences that we know of, chemistry, physics, math, and chemistry, physics, biology, and so on. And then we went along developing those ideas for another couple centuries, and now comes the era of decades of change. And that happened when, at the end of the 19th century, we had a complete transformation of science, which is based on the fact that our technology allowed us to see things that we couldn't see or detect with our senses. So prior to this, all the work that was ever done in science had to do with things that we could see. We had things like telescopes or microscopes that aided our eyes, but essentially everything we worked on were things that we could observe. And now at the end of the 19th century, we started to be able to detect things like X-rays and see the indirect effects of electrons as they hit a phosphorescent screen and so on. And we started to find other laws and to see that the laws that we had didn't really hold in those realms. And that was a time of great upheaval in science, because a lot of the existing scientists who had been practicing up until that time couldn't accept that science should describe concepts and work with ideas about things that we couldn't actually see. These were fantasies, and why should we consider them? And so that was another great revolution, and it took some decades. So that's the timeline that the book follows as it goes through the history of science. But I didn't write the book really to talk about the history of science. I wrote the book to talk about how science is done. This is a picture of my father the night he proposed to my mother at a Tavern on the Green in New York. And they had both gone through the Holocaust. They met in New York after the war. And my father was in the underground and later in a concentration camp. And in his experiences, he saw really the worst of humanity, but he also saw the best of humanity and a lot of heroism. And he had a seventh grade education. And ironically, when I hit around seventh grade, he got very interested in science and in talking to me about my science. But he didn't care very much to know what the theories of science were. He cared to know what they told us about the human condition and how we did science, and he wanted to know how the fact that people investigate science, what it tells us about people themselves. And so that's really what I wrote the book for, to explain all that. He died, unfortunately, 25 years ago, but better late than never, so that's the book. So in school, this is what we learned science is about, the scientific method. We ask a question, we state a hypothesis, then we either conduct an experiment, or an experiment can be an observation to test it. If you're an astrophysicist, you can't build a star in your lab, but you can make predictions about what happens, and you can look into the skies. And we analyze the results, and this informs our hypothesis. Maybe it tells us we were wrong, maybe it tells us we should change it, or maybe it gives support for it. So that's the classic scientific method. And not too long ago, my daughter, who's 14, freshman in high school, came home, and this is what I wrote about in the New York Times editorial. She said, Daddy, I've learned about the scientific method and about how Darwin applied that and how he learned about evolution. And she told me the whole story, and I looked that up in her book. This is from her textbook. And it tells us about how Darwin found evidence for his theory from the finches in the Galapagos Islands. He noted that the finches, there were different species on different islands, and there were also different habitats on different islands, and that the beaks of the finches matched the needs of the finches on those different islands due to the differing habitats. And so this is an example of how species could change and that the fittest would survive, and then eventually species would differentiate. So that fit in very nicely with what she had learned in school, and this is just another example from the BBC website that tells the same story. And it's a nice story and very neat. The only problem is it's totally wrong. It's a myth. It didn't happen that way at all. In fact, not only did it happen that way, Darwin was not a very good ornithologist. He couldn't tell a finch from a blackbird. In fact, he mislabeled a lot of the finches blackbirds and grosbeaks. And he didn't have the foresight, or he didn't realize at the time, that it would even be important to know which islands they came from, so they weren't labeled by island. So it's quite impossible that this story could even be true. But it's one of the myths that we tell about science. So in my book, in this talk, I want to give you a few lessons about how scientific discoveries are really made. I'm going on and on, and there's a lot in the book, so I'm going to give you a taste of this today, and here's what I want you to come away with. First of all, that science is far more complicated than these myths portray. This is important, that most pioneer, quote, geniuses experience failure after failure after failure, before they hit any success. And a lot of very smart people never hit a great success, and that's fine too. But science just isn't easy, and it's a good lesson for life, because in business and in our personal lives, we can also experience failure. And I think that we should understand that that's not a bad thing. That's just a natural thing, and that we keep going on, and eventually we can reach success. It's important to know that scientists are often confused about their theories right up until the time that they complete them. It's not that you go like Darwin, I have this theory of evolution, let's go to the Galapagos, oh, here's evidence, wow, it works. It's not like that at all. And in fact, scientists are often confused about their theories even after they complete them. So the theories that we read about that I read about when I was a graduate student that seemed very well digested and beautiful were not at all what the people who came up with the theories thought. They were confused about them, and decades or centuries of people who work on that refine and explain the theories of the people who came up with them. And that's how we get to the theories that we learn about in our books. Even F equals MA, you would think that Newton came up with that. No, it came up 100 years after Newton. So it's the ideas that we have in science are not what the discoverers thought they were. Another point is that this is related to especially to the failure point. Most scientists' ideas prove wrong. So, among scientists, this is quite common to laugh about. And as a physicist, I know friends of mine. Whenever we come up with an idea, we always, "Oh, I'm probably wrong. I usually am, but what about this?" And it's good to be able to accept that. It's like when you learn to ski. The first thing I learned was fall down at the beginning of the day, get that over with, and now I'm not going to try and I'm going to be really stiff all day because I'm afraid of falling down, or I don't want to break my record of not falling down. I fell down and I got up and now I can ski. And that's the way it is in science too. So if you're actually practicing science, you have to understand that you don't know everything. Scientists, and if you ask me questions, I'll be very happy to say I don't know, and that you're often wrong. So that's very liberating, and it's an important part of science. So you put all that together, this point almost summarizes everything. Throughout the history of science, curiosity, stubbornness, and what psychologists call grit are more important than insight. And grit is the ability to go through failure, go through barriers, to remain undaunted, to be the ever-ready bunny. And psychologists have been studying this a lot over the last 10, 15 years, and they found that not just in science, but in fields from the military and the Green Berets and special forces to marriage, grit is the most important factor when you look at when you make correlations between people's characteristics and their success. All right, so with that preface, I'll go to my first story. I have three stories that I'm going to tell. The first, I call this Darwin's Barnacles, the real Darwin story, and you'll see why it's called that. And this one especially illustrates the point about myths, and all my stories are going to illustrate the grit, so that'll just be highlighted. Oh, you can't even see the highlights here. Well, anyway, this one is yellow, and the other one's... All right, so that's the point of this one. And the first step really was what the scientific method says. And I don't want to say we don't use the scientific method. We do test theories and do experiments by that, but making discoveries is a far different enterprise. And the first step that Darwin had was indeed, what shall I do with my life, though, was his question. So, and that's a very good question. Now, Darwin was a devout Christian, but I suspect that his father might have been Jewish, because the first thing his father wanted him to do was to become a doctor. And he made him go to medical school. And when Darwin went to medical school, he couldn't take it because it was very bloody in those days. And when they did operations, people had no anesthetic, and people were screaming, and he was a little too queasy for that. So he quit medical school, and he was looking for what else to do. And the next thing he looked at was to be a clergyman. And he thought that being a clergyman might not be a bad idea because, he was very religious, but he just felt that it may be a little too quiet a life for him. And so he was looking, searching around for what he should do with his life when he got this letter, this invitation, do you want to be the naturalist on the Beagle? And the naturalist position was an interesting position. So as a naturalist, you do go and collect specimens, but that's not really why Darwin was invited. He was invited to be basically the gentleman friend of the captains. And why would he do that? Because The voyage takes several years, and the captain of the ship is of a higher social class than the crew of the ship, and by the social standards of those days was not allowed to speak to the crew or to eat with the crew. So it was a very lonely job being captain. And in fact, the prior captain got so depressed that he killed himself. And this current captain, who was going to go on this voyage, was the second in command on that voyage, and he was hoping for a different outcome. So he started to seek a rich gentleman scholar to be his naturalist, and Darwin was seeking adventure, so he said yes. But Darwin actually wasn't that interested in being a naturalist. He actually went on the ship hoping to study geology. So this was the situation when they went, and here's an excerpt from a letter that Darwin wrote at the start of the cruise. "Geology and the invertebrate animals would be my chief object of pursuit through the whole voyage." At the end of the cruise, did he discover evolution, look at all the finches and get really excited? Did he say, "Oh my God, I have this great new theory, it's gonna revolutionize humanity, and whoopee-doo, this was a great voyage"? No, what he said was, "During this cruise, I've done little except in geology." And indeed, that's what he did, little except in geology. And when he got back to England, he indeed got famous as a geologist. So he was invited to speak in many places to talk about his observations in geology. His ideas of evolution developed over the next years. They were spurred by reports that were coming in from naturalists who had looked at his specimens and analyzed them. And of course, the idea of evolution was in the air. Even Darwin's grandfather had worked on evolution. But nobody ended up doing what Darwin did. And see, before Darwin, evolution was really not much better than a theological idea. The theologian said every animal was placed on the earth and they haven't changed. And the evolutionaries said, "Oh yeah, no, they have changed, but that doesn't make it a scientific idea." And what Darwin did was he figured out a mechanism for evolution, and he collected a ton of evidence and data over many years to back up his case, which is why his explanation was accepted. Just to give you an example, this is just one of the many byproducts of his studies over those years. It's a 658-page book on barnacles. So he was so intent on understanding his evolution that he delved very deeply into this, and just one byproduct was that. I can show you graphically a good example of the effort that went into it and the toll it took on Darwin. This is a picture of Darwin when he started working on evolution, and this is a picture of Darwin when he finished. Looks pretty grumpy by that time, too. Some of the things he did, he studied the animals in the London Zoo. He fed birds seeds, and he studied their poop, because he was interested in how plants might migrate from one area to another, and one major way of doing that is in birds, either in their feathers or in their stomachs. And he was interested in how long seeds could remain in there and whether they would be viable when they came out the other end. He examined the work of pigeon, dog, and horse breeders and what he called artificial selection, where they form new breeds. Despite being so queasy, in the end, ironically, he did end up doing a lot of surgeries on dead animals to compare their anatomy. He made great famous studies of the emotions of primates and their facial expressions and how they reflect their emotions, and did the same for people and people from different countries and different cultures to see if they were universal, and found many universalities among not just people's facial expressions, but also our other primates. And that's a book that's still being referred to today. And he studied, of course, the barnacles, and he did many other things. So the true timeline is he was a creationist the entire 5 years on the Beagle. The next year he started developing his theory, and it took him 5 years to get his theory to a point where he could state it, and that was just a 35-page manuscript. And that's even slower than me, 7 pages a year. And he still was a creationist at that point. So he had modified his creationism, but he still believed in creationism and believed in the Christian description of the world. His modification was that God put animals on the earth at the beginning in certain habitats with the plan or the design that they will evolve, and that indeed what we're observing is that they have evolved according to God's plan. So he just changed creationism a little bit, but was still very religious. And what finally killed his faith in God was not evolution at all, but when his 10-year-old daughter Annie died in 1851. And 7 years later, he announced his theory, so he worked on it for 20 years refining his ideas and gathering evidence, a far cry from looking at a few finches on the islands. And now just a quick aside about the destructive effects of myths. You know, there are a lot of issues in science today, in politics today, that have to do with science. And I'm sure everybody here is very aware of that, and they read Michael's magazine, so what people say. And I think that these myths are destructive in that they imply that science is easier and less deep, less complex than it really is. If you think that Darwin can see finches and come up with a revolutionary theory of evolution, that's all there is to it, or that Newton can see an apple fall, and the next thing you know, society has changed because he has this new theory, then I guess you can believe that you can see a kid who had a vaccination, for instance, and then becomes autistic and think, that's the theory, that must be true. But you know, in reality, here's just one example of an article on autism, an early article. They examined almost 500 cases. They did a very involved mathematical analysis, and over the years since then, more than 2,000 researchers have not only done their own work, but referred to this work, and there is just a lot of work being done on it, just like Darwin did a lot of work to come up with evolution. Yet the myths encourage things like this from Rand Paul, that he sees kids who got mental disorders after vaccines, so that must be what causes them. And so I think that it's important for people to understand what science is, and if they don't already understand how idiotic statements like this are, I'm hoping to spread that word. So here's another example from physics of how complex science is, and this will also illustrate how things have changed just in the last decades. This is the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. When we say we saw the Higgs boson, this is where we saw it, okay? It's a laboratory that's 27 kilometers around. It's hard to see on this, but those guys down there are standing inside it. If it were to run nonstop, it would use this one lab would consume as much energy as the country of Madagascar. So I named the unit for it. It uses one Madagascar of energy per year. That's what, that's a lot for a physics lab, I think. I believe that the Large Hadron Collider is a prime example of the most sophisticated and impressive example of human cooperation in history. We have thousands of scientists in dozens of countries working together using thousands of computers that are all linked up. They're taking very detailed and intricate electronic data, analyzing it, putting it all together, and comparing it to a theory and coming to a result that's accurate to several decimal places. And this is something that definitely chimpanzees cannot do. But this shows what, you know, that the best of humanity is not just survival, but is this kind of investigation into nature. But this illustrates another thing I want to point out, which is what it means to see something in science today. So until around the end of the 19th century, to see something in science was to really see it, you could touch it, you experience it. Then we start to get these indirect observations, as I said, of things like x-rays that may make darken a photographic plate and so on. But today we've gone far, far beyond that. So what we mean here is, we never saw a Higgs boson. A Higgs boson decays extremely quickly, so we can't see it. Then it decays into other things, and they decay into other things, and eventually we see the results of those things as they hit our electronics. So that in itself is almost like 100 years ago where we'd see an electron hitting something, even though it's not the electron. Now we need the theory to explain what we think the electron will turn into and then compare that to the data. But it's not even that, because that one incident is not what we see. What we do is we observe millions and millions of incidents of this. We collect and we aggregate the data from all that, and we statistically analyze it. And after all of that, we compare that statistical analysis of what happened to the statistical predictions that the theory said should happen. And then we say we saw one, but nobody knew when or where they saw one. It's all millions of different things happening that we later conclude is evidence for one. So that's how science is done today. And just to show you, the experiment, but to show you the theory that people are comparing it to, that's this. So this is the equation for the Higgs boson, and it's called the standard model. It takes two pages. It describes all the forces and particles of nature except for what has to do with gravity. And this theory, as you can see, is not an easy theory to state, even to write down. In order to understand this, you have to know things like, of course, calculus and differential equations and Hilbert spaces, and you have to understand group theory because it involves symmetries, and, linear algebra, that's pretty easy for the matrices, and you also have to know a lot of physics phenomenology, so you know what kind of what particles we're talking about. And to fill this in and to fine-tune this to the state that it's in took thousands of people, many years. It's not like Newton's laws, F equals ma. So that's what we mean when we do all, You could do all that and understand this completely, and you'd be nowhere, because we can't solve these equations either. So to solve the equations, you have to learn about something that was associated with someone who, right here at Caltech, Feynman diagrams, and you have to use computers to do the calculations, and then we get the answers that we compare to what those experimentalists do. So that's an example of how it works today. So that takes me to my second story, which I call, We May Be Right, But We Doubt It. And you'll see why I say that. It's the story of quantum mechanics. And I included as an illustration an equation because I just want you to compare. This is a cutting edge equation from 100 years ago. It's the equation for describes a helium atom. And I can explain it pretty easily. You see the helium atom is two electrons. Those are the red dots, and the blue dot in the middle is the nucleus. There is an attraction with the electrons that's proportional to 1 over r, to the inverse of r, the distance, r1, and the other one, r2. So that's those two terms in the equation that have the r1 and the r2 in the denominator. Then there's a repulsion between the electrons, so that's the final term. It has a plus sign instead of a minus sign because it's a repulsion. See how easy it is? And the r1, 2 is that distance. So you can understand it in those upside-down triangles. It's just a funny way of writing certain calculus things, and that represents the kinetic energy. And so that's today's equation, and you can see it's a lot different. That's yesterday's equation. It's a lot different from today's equations. So this story in particular will focus on that scientists are confused about their theories until the moment they complete them, and even after they complete them. So let's see how that goes. This is Max Planck. Now, I practiced this talk in front of my 14-year-old daughter, the evolution daughter, and she said, Daddy, Daddy, Max Planck couldn't have discovered quantum mechanics. He only lived to be 3 years old. But those are not his dates. Those are the dates that he beat his head against the wall and failed again and again and again, and he discovered nothing. So those are dates on which he worked on what eventually led to quantum theory but discovered nothing. And I like Max Planck because I have a complicated name, Mladenov, or if I'm on the radio, I usually say Mladenow, so you can look me up. But when I go to a restaurant, I don't want to fool around with all that confusion. So when I'm making a reservation at a restaurant, I say my name is Max Planck. I feel good, and no one ever knows except for one time. And so that usually works for me. Now, Max Planck, I said that people don't know what they're doing until they discover their theory. Well, here's what he thought he was doing. He wanted to prove that there's no such thing as atoms. So that's what he started in 1897. Set out to do. Actually, he had started trying to do that earlier than that even. So he was one of those people in the 19th century who said, atoms, you know, you can try and make theories about them, but yeah, we can't see them, they're hypothetical, it doesn't have a place in science. And so he decided to work on something called black body radiation, which is the radiation that things give off due to their heat. It doesn't matter what they're made of, there's a certain characteristic radiation that things give off just due to their temperature. And that was something that people were very interested in at the time. The light bulb had just been invented, and people wanted to know what temperatures and to put the light bulb at to get the most visible light and so on. And they were looking at the curves like this that describe how much radiation is given at each wavelength or each frequency based on the temperature. So if you look at those curves, each curve represents a different temperature. Oh, there is, okay. Yeah, it works. Look at me. Okay, so each curve represents a different temperature. And the height of the curve represents how much radiation is given off at that frequency or that wavelength. And you can see the visible part of the wavelength spectrum are indicated there. And so you can see that it varies, it has a certain peak depending on the temperature, and then it goes down at higher frequencies and lower frequencies. And that's what he wanted to explain. And we can explain it today on using the idea of atoms, that there's these charged particles and everything, and temperature makes them jiggle around. And when charged particles move, accelerate like that, they give off energy, so we can explain it. But he didn't want to use any ideas like that, and he failed. So he finally said, forget about explaining it. Let me just describe it. Can I come up with an equation that describes that curve? So here he did. He managed to guess a mathematical formula that tells you for any given temperature what that curve should look like for all wavelengths, or this one's in terms of frequency. So that's his equation. He just totally guessed that mathematical form. And when you plug in the numbers, you get that curve. This other curve that says classical next to it is the curve that Newton's law predicts if you do the math for Newton using Newton's laws. And people knew that that couldn't possibly be right. It doesn't match the experiments, and it goes off to infinity. So that's totally bogus, but that's what Newton's laws predicted. Nobody thought that was a failure of Newton's laws. They thought that was a failure of humans, of the physicists, who didn't understand the materials well enough, and that there was something in the materials that changed things, and they would eventually figure out why that analysis, that simple analysis, doesn't work. But Planck at least guessed it, so he went to he trotted over to the October 1900 meeting of the Berlin Physical Society and announced his results, and everyone said, "Oh, wow, that's really good." They didn't know how good it was, because in the days before databases and computers and calculators, it wasn't that easy to match the data with the, or even to have the data, because it wasn't disseminated to everybody. They couldn't just look it up on the internet. So they thought it looked pretty good, and they were very happy that he discovered this mathematical form. That night, a friend of his who was an experimentalist went home and compared it to the data, and was up all night, because comparing, you know, painstakingly point by point on the curve with all his data, and finding that, oh my God, this is too good to be true. This is much better than it has any right to be. And he went to Planck's house in the morning and woke him up and told him that. So now Planck is going, oh my God, I guessed the mathematical form of the law, but how do I now I need to derive it. And so here he illustrated a certain trait that was something that Einstein admired very much in him, which was he was open-minded enough to say, maybe I should use those pesky atoms and see if I can use those atoms to derive this. And he gave up his quest to find evidence against them, and he started to see if he could derive this using the idea of atoms. And he found he could do that if he made one other really weird assumption. And that weird assumption was that the atoms couldn't have just any energy. Like, think of your car. You can go 5 miles an hour, or 5.1, or 53.75. You can go any speed you want. But for atoms, he found it's as if the atom could only go 0, 10, 20, 30, like that. That's what we call quantized. So if atoms could only have a certain discrete set of energies, then he could derive his law using the idea of atoms. So he goes back in December 1900, back to the next meeting of the Berlin Physical Society, and tells everyone, hey, I can explain it now. And he gets even more excitement from a lot of people. But the excitement is not what you might think it is, because physicists tend to be conservative, and nobody was thinking that he had found any exception to Newton's laws by doing this. What most people thought was that he had discovered the thing about materials that we didn't understand that made this law work this way. But we still don't know why that's happening, but this was like the next step. So this was the kind of explanation that people thought it was, but they didn't think that it was anything deep or generally important. And some of them didn't even like that, okay? And in particular, Sir James Jeans, who came up, one of the people who came up with that classical law, he basically said, I know that Planck's law agrees with the experiment and mine doesn't, but I like mine better anyway. And this is a technical way of saying that. And to me, I found that Robert Frost had great insight into his thinking when he said, why abandon a belief merely because it ceases to be true? And that seems to be James Jeans' motto, too. So for the next 5 years, no one did any work on the quantum theory. There was not a single paper published to follow up Planck's work. And then finally, some young kid comes along who tended to take his strength in physics was that he tended to take ideas seriously and not have this narrow view that that we'll figure it out later, but it's not something revolutionary. And so that guy's name was Albert Einstein. And Einstein interpreted Planck's principle, he was the first one to do this, as a general law of nature. And so Planck had said that atoms, or these things inside the material, can only have certain energies, but Einstein said, no, but it's a general law of nature. The same thing is true of electromagnetic radiation. So the light that comes off is also like that. And so he hypothesized that light comes in packets that we today call photons. He called them quanta of light. So he made that hypothesis based on Planck's work and said that we really need to look at this and make this a general theory. Now, I do sometimes radio talk shows, and there people call in, and they like to tell me their general theories, too, like Einstein. And, I usually don't delve into them too deeply, but they're not, I'm assuming they're not quite as good as Einstein's, but then they ask me what I think of them, and I can't really tell them what I think of them, because in order to think anything of them, they have to formulate their theory in a precise mathematical way and then show me what it says. And if Einstein had just said Planck's idea, you know, he could be a call-in guy. At this level, he could have called in to some. Of course, I don't think there were radios quite in 1905, but there were maybe experimental radios. And he could have said, I have this theory. And it would sound just like these people do, actually. Right, Michael? It would. So he would say, I have this theory. Planck, his idea is a general principle of nature, and light is quantized just like atoms are. And yes, that would sound just like these people who call in. But luckily, he did one more thing. He applied this idea and he explained something called the photoelectric effect. So the photoelectric effect is the effect that when light hits certain metals, it kicks electrons off the metal, and you can get an electric current that way, and so it's useful in electronics. And people had been studying that for years. I mean, like blackbody radiation, Newton's laws didn't seem to work, didn't match what the characteristics of that of what they were measuring. And Einstein showed that using this idea, he could do that. So that was just like Planck did. He explained this another unexplained phenomenon using these new ideas. And so, what was the reaction? Well, here's a quote. I'll give you a quote from somebody who wrote a 8 years after this wrote a recommendation for Einstein to get the Nobel Prize for his explanation of the photoelectric effect. This guy was actually Max Planck himself. And what did he say? He said, well, Einstein's done a lot of really good things in physics. The only stupid thing he did was this quanta of light thing, and we should forgive him for that because he did so many other things that are really important. So Planck didn't like Einstein taking his theory and saying it's really important and going on with it, and a lot of other people didn't either. There was a huge opposition to this photon idea because physicists grew up thinking light is waves, and now Einstein's saying it's particles, and people had a hard time accepting that, especially the older people. And in fact, Max Planck, I see someone going, yeah, he's one of the, no. I look a lot older than I am. So Max Planck has a quote is often quoted as saying something that he didn't actually say, just like these myths arise in science. They arise in all areas, including quotations. But first of all, what he said was in German, so it's automatically not elegant. And I speak German, so I can say that. But even the translation was nothing like it comes down to us as, but what people now sometimes quote Max Planck as having said is, science advances funeral by funeral. And so that's really what happened in quantum theory in a way, or at least if the people weren't dead, they were marginalized and the new people came along. And that's a good thing about science, that happens, so we don't get stuck believing in authority and the written word and referring to things from 20 years ago. We all go, no, you know, we're going to look at the ideas of the new people. So what finally put quantum mechanics on the map to stay was these two guys, Heisenberg and Schrodinger. Now, this is annoying to me because Heisenberg is a very important guy in physics, and he basically invented quantum mechanics, or co-invented it. And if you Google Heisenberg, you know, the first thing you get are two pages of Breaking Bad, the Heisenberg on Breaking Bad. So even the most famous scientist can get kicked off the headlines of history by a TV show. I think it's really annoying, but at least if you call a restaurant and give the name Heisenberg, they'll recognize it, right? So what they did was they invented, so up until then, people like Einstein, Planck, and Niels Bohr had come up with ideas, and Louis de Broglie, ideas that were important in quantum theory, but they were not connected. They were all ad hoc ideas to explain this or that. And these two invented a new equation, each a different equation, that replaces Newton's laws with quantum laws. So they replaced Newton's laws of motion with a quantum version, and that's why they got so famous. It's an interesting story, though, because Heisenberg published his first. Schrodinger read it. He said, I hate this. let me come up with something better. And then he found his, and then he published his. And so he really published his as a reaction to Heisenberg's. And then what happened, what was the reaction to these two guys' work? Okay, so the first is, of course, we all know Einstein didn't like it, right? Because Einstein, at this point, people realized that probability and uncertainty has something to do with quantum theory, and Einstein couldn't accept that. So he turned against it. Now, Schrödinger came up with his version because he didn't like Heisenberg's, and he went to work to find a difference between them. And he got very upset because it got proved that the theories are actually equivalent. So they look different, they describe different concepts, they deal with different concepts, and they look completely different mathematically, but you can prove, it turns out, that they are mathematically equivalent. You can go from one to the other. Schrödinger really didn't like that, and he hated it so much that he kind of regretted having come up with his theory at all, because to the extent that it supports Heisenberg's. Well, guess who proved that the two theories are equivalent? It was Schrödinger. So Schrödinger himself, when he was investigating the differences, he found that there were none, and that his theory was the same. And then he turned against it too. And what did Heisenberg say? Heisenberg said, the more I look at Schrödinger's theory, the more disgusting I find it. It's a bunch of crap. So this is how science is really done in the real world, as opposed to the mythological world. Okay, before my last story, I want to play a little game. That's Tesla. I don't mean to say he's... Well, I don't know how mad he was. He was awesome, but I like the image. So the game is, who's the crackpot? Here's what this man believed. The floor plan of the lost temple of King Solomon in Jerusalem contains mathematical hints regarding the end of the world. He believed that Moses, Pythagoras, and Plato had all discovered the law of gravity before Newton and encoded it in text to hide it. He believed the truths of nature are contained in code in the Bible, and that a mixture of turpentine, beeswax, rose water, and olive oil will cure tuberculosis and other diseases. All right, so the question is, who was that crackpot? Isaac Newton. So I think that Isaac Newton lends support to Thomas Edison's line, to have a great idea, have a lot of them. Well, we know a lot about Newton, because if Newton were alive today, he could be on a reality show. Anyone guess which one? Yell it out. The Hoarders. This is not Newton's office, but it could well have been. Newton kept, first of all, he wrote down all his thoughts in journals and diaries, and he kept them all, never threw it away, never threw away his calculations. If he wrote a grocery list and went into town, he kept that. He kept the receipts from everything he bought. So we know a lot about Newton, and that's good for the history of science. And what it's going to show us here is, as I said, that most scientists' ideas prove wrong, and that most pioneer geniuses have many failures. I'm sorry, did I say prove? Illustrate, sorry. I'm as bad as it. So one thing that we see from his papers is that he didn't have a miracle year in 1665 and 1666. We can see his thinking in great detail, and he was very confused and didn't come close to a theory of motion and gravity. After that, he worked on optics and algebra for some years. Then he got into a fight with Robert Hooke, who was a brilliant man who made contributions in biology, chemistry, and physics, and always played second fiddle, and he did to Newton as well. And the fight with Hooke led him to withdraw, and then he spent over the next decade doing other things pretty much alone at home. And that was alchemy, for one. He had, if not the greatest, one of the greatest, most comprehensive labs of alchemy in the world at the time, and he owned every single book that had ever been published on alchemy. And he owned a lot of heavy metals, too. You could see them in his hair and his skin, his teeth after he died. Analysis of his remains showed that he had 15 times the legal limit of mercury in his hair, or I forgot if it was his hair or his bones, and high levels of other heavy metals. And he spent a lot more time working on his ideas in alchemy than he ever did in physics. And they were wrong ideas, but they weren't totally out there if you look at it. And he's not looking generally for the elixir of life and crazy ideas. I mean, they sound crazy, but he was trying to invent chemistry, and it just wasn't working for him. And he also did a lot of Bible analysis, and he continued, actually, even after the 1680s, he continued that work. So by the time 1684 came along, had he died, historian and Newton biographer Richard Westfall said that Had he died at age 41, we would at most mention him in brief paragraphs, lamenting his failure to reach fulfillment. So what happened? Well, a couple things happened in 1684. Edmund Halley came by from comet fame, and he was interested in why planets moved in ellipses. He had read about Kepler's laws, and he wanted to explain them. And he happened to be passing through Cambridge, and asked Newton if he could explain that with the inverse square law. Well, it happens that also years earlier, Robert Hooke had written Newton a letter talking about how you can break down circular or elliptical motion into two components, a tangential part that's flying straight off the circle, and then a radial part that's bringing it back. And Newton realized that with his calculus, if you made that forms a sawtooth kind of motion, but if you use calculus, you can shrink that down and pretty much approximate the circle or the ellipse that way, and that was important in his thinking. So that was another ingredient that he didn't want to acknowledge, and that and Hooke thought was all that there was to Newton's work, and both of them were wrong, but it was an important element. And the other ingredient was 2 years of 100-hour work week. So Halley kept saying, just let me publish this result, just let me publish, because it just took him a couple of weeks to answer Halley's question, but Newton realized that there's much more there, and he went back to his thoughts that he had over the years, and now he just decided he really wanted to figure it out, and so he finished Principia. And in that book, he doesn't just give the three laws of motion that you learn in school. It's not that simple. It's not three laws, it's three volumes of work. And he applied his laws to many different things, so he found a lot of evidence for his ideas. It wasn't just stating them. For instance, of course, he calculated the rate of fall, but he did it better than one part in 3,000. He even took into account the deviations of the Earth from being a perfect sphere. He explained the marine tides. He calculated the speed of sound in air, so he made the assumption that air is made of particles. And with that limited knowledge, he could explain the speed of sound. He calculated how gravity causes irregularities in the motion of the moon, and he explained the precession of the Earth's axis. And this is what it looked like, so it wasn't easy. He didn't use equations in general. He used geometry, and it's very hairy stuff if you look at this. Even apart from its Latin, I mean, the diagrams look like Latin to me too. To do this in geometry, you had to make a lot of very intricate geometric constructions. And so that's what took up his 100-hour work weeks. An interesting story about Newton is that his cousin Humphrey Newton said that in all his years, he had only seen Newton laugh once. And why did he laugh? It was when someone asked him, why on earth would anyone want to study Euclid? So I hope I've given you some taste of how we've gotten from stone tools to modern science and some of the characteristics of science. And of course, today we have a lot of triumphs. We've discovered We've discovered a lot of stars that are like our sun and thousands of planets that could be like our Earth. And we've looked back at the early universe and we decoded the blueprint for a human being. But the most important thing we've done is we've helped ourselves. This is a graph of life expectancy over the centuries. And as you can see, it hovered between 35 and 40 for hundreds and hundreds of years. And what happened was around early 19th century, when science started feeding into the Industrial Revolution, which had started some decades earlier, we started to invent new machines and tools, new chemicals and medicines that made life a lot easier and healthier, and we've been on a steady climb ever since. So science has proved to be a great survival benefit to us after all. And I just want to end with two quotes, one from Albert Einstein, who said, two quotes about the soul of a scientist. The most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is a sense of the mysterious. And from Tom Stoppard, the playwright, who said it even more eloquently, I think, he said that for a scientist, it's the best possible time to be alive when almost everything you thought you knew is wrong. Thank you.